welcome everybody to the Ontology Summit 2012 Session 7. This session is on the Crosstrack A1, Ontology Quality and Large Scale Systems. I am Amanda Weisman, co-champion. Joining us at some point soon, hopefully, will be the other co-champion, Mike Bennett. Today we will be talking about implementing ontology quality measures in big systems engineering. Slide 2 of the intro slides, I've put up the Crosstrack mission statement. I won't read through it, but it's there as a refresher for anyone. Slide 3, the more specific focus of today's session. I won't read through this, but just to reiterate a few points, one of which is that it's a specific focus of this Crosstrack session to think about ontology quality in the engineering sense of it, that is, in which quality is defined as the ability to meet requirements. So many of the more abstract or theoretical questions about ontology quality that have been well discussed are sort of out of the scope for today, and we're focusing more on the pragmatic issues that are actually usable in real systems engineering contexts. Slide 4 has our agenda for today. For the most part, we're following a fairly typical Ontology Summit format in that we've got a panel. Each of our guest speakers for today will present a short presentation, and we'll have a little tiny bit of room right after each one for just some clarificatory questions. We'll save the main discussion till all presenters have gone. We'll have some Q&A and open discussion time then, and then we're going to, assuming that we've managed to discipline ourselves into managing our time correctly, we're going to do something a little bit different at the very end and have some Q&A directed to the community at large, in which the questions will be posted and the answers gathered via the chat. So, without further ado, I think we'll go right to the first of our speakers. Aldo, are you ready?
Okay, thanks. So I've loaded quite a bunch of slides. There are 40. Actually, I will present half of them since the others are for those that want a bit more details, either during the presentation or on any extra time. So I will start. I will present something about ontology evaluation in the perspective that my lab started researching in around 2005, and then move to our successive approach to ontology quality based on patterns and design patterns and so on. Then in slide 2, I will make some. This is interesting for the fact that, okay, I anticipate something. So we have a portal called ontologydesignpatterns.org that collects these good practices on all kinds of areas of ontology design. And there is a page that we, during the NEON European project some years ago, asked to organized. This page was a template was made, and this was designed by Mike Kuschelt, and it was a page about exemplary ontologies. And there we asked for justifications from the people that were going to upload their exemplary ontologies. And then recently we started analyzing and classifying them according to the classes of our ontology measures that were defined in 2005. Anticipate them, they are basically the structure of the ontology that relates to, for example, the graph structure of the ontology or the formal structure. The other classes are conceptual coverage or conceptual tasks, so what the ontology is supposed to be about and or for what task should be about, and finally about pragmatic or social sustainability. And the most frequent justifications were from the two classes, task and social sustainability. So in the next slide that I'm not going to present, actually you find the collection of the justifications that were included in the page. For example, in slide 5, you have the three that can be considered as task justifications, task-oriented justifications. And three are being oriented at an explicit task, having spelled out requirements from scenarios, and being based on competency questions. On slide 6, you can also see justification based on social sustainability, like being the result of an evolution, so having many revisions, or having wide usage or acceptance, or having even a commercial impact, or being recommended by industry. This is quite the case nowadays that, for example, we are dealing with things like knowledge graph from Google, and implementing scientific knowledge. These were the two sets of justifications that were found most often in this set. Then we move to slide 8. I have summarized it to 6. The notions of quality that have emerged from the Ontolog Summit discussion on quality. Actually, I wasn't able to follow everything. So things like what ontology to use, how to measure, evaluate it, any requirements that are specified, this interesting analogy to the quality assurance about requirements, about design, production, and to check against the quality. And then the interesting made by John Sowa on is there any successful revision story, history about the torches. In slide 9, I anticipate what is my position, and then I will try to summarize something about this, my answers here. For example, what ontology to use, then you have some alternatives concerning, for example, matching requirements, your requirements to repositories. For example, in the Watson ontology search, or on the ontology design pattern portal that is abbreviated ODP, this presentation, from recommendations, the open rating, and from also there's even a tool of the Neon Toolkit called XD that allows you to make some advanced search on reusable components called ontology or knowledge patterns. On the second question, how to measure, evaluate. So there is a reference to this work that tried to describe some measures, especially structural, that then described also some parametric approach to define your own metric and some principles, and then you can calculate, in a sense, you can verify your ontology based on the metric that you have defined based on your principles. I won't talk about this, by the way. And this also from an ex post viewpoint. So you have some ontologies that you want to evaluate them or to select them based on principles and metric. From an ex ante perspective, you may want to follow what we call extreme design methods. So it's pattern-based ontology design. And this includes using competency questions and using patterns and using unit tests to evaluate. So this is quite close, quite analogous to a quality assurance, in a sense. Concerning any requirements are, we always supposed to be encoded into, to be represented by means of the competency question-based approach by Michael Gruinger. Concerning analogy to quality assurance, yeah, in a sense, you can either use this good ex post approach by defining your own principles and metric, or the extreme design by implementing ex ante methods. And then, having any successful revision story, there is in the stream design workflow, there is this monitoring from the integrators in a kind of pair design approach. Okay. So I am anticipating a lot that I will try to explain, but please refer to the slide, to the additional slides and to the reference works and for having more details. Of course, we are just introducing something and we don't have the time to present anything. So in slide 10, I make a recap about the quality measure classification that emerged in this research work from some 7 years ago. So we singled out these three quality dimensions, structural content and sustainability, where content clearly appeared as the primary dimension. And content, by the way, also the compliance to content for an ontology spanned to three different aspects, which has the coverage with respect, for example, to the terminology of a domain, with a task, and with being self-explanatory, so being able to be understood. And indeed, the task seemed to be the immediately measurable aspect. And also we found out that quality is not maximal and abstract, but bound to context. And also that we could have analogies. So we have partial orders of problems and reusable solutions. And also we have to gain from past stories. So I mean, good practices from the evolution of our community. So in slide 11, I will be here. You can find some dimension of some tools that actually perform structural and also some good practices check-in, and this includes measuring the graph aspects of ontology, reasoners, some custom tests, user rank-based measures like the operating system by order 11, and we also have this XD analyzer implemented in the Debian Toolkit XD plugin that I already mentioned. So in slide 12, this is about the core aspects that we then wanted to support with pattern-based design. So the fact that the ontology should match both domain and task. So the idea is that ontology should allow the description of the entities whose attributes and relations are concerned because of some purpose. So you'll find some examples in the slide. And also they should serve a purpose, a task. So for example, if you have social events and agents considered in a legal case, you may want them to find entities that are considered in the same legal case as a task. In slide 13, there is a reference, it should be very short, to the fact that this the patterns that we have in mind and that are probably related to this task-oriented aspect, not only the coverage one, are the so-called expertise patterns. So there are quite a bunch of findings in the cognitive science area about the fact that units of expertise, it's on one hand larger than what we have on average linked data triples or from typical ontology learning, but on the other hand, they are not too large. So they typically allow us to gain these blinking effects when we react to events or we evaluate actions and theories on the other, so understanding context or interpreting news and apps and so on. So the idea is that competency questions could be quite good at being paired to these kind of small expertise patterns and then to try to convey these units as requirements. This you find here some examples. Of course, these are positive examples of competency questions. You can also have exception conditions. You can have negative examples that you want to allow, or stress tests onto ontologies, or you may want to have also inference aspects that should be supported. And so there is a large spectrum of competency questions that should be considered. So that, by the way, I will concentrate mainly on the first one, which is the positive set of competency questions. I will show also some anti-patterns later. So our solution in slide 14 is having ontology design patterns as reusable, successful solutions to a recurrent modeling problems. There is quite a history about this that starts at least from competency questions by Michael Gruninger, but also in the design pattern movement by Christopher Alexander, by Peter Clark from Boeing on knowledge patterns, from a W3C working group that worked in 2003 and 2004 on semantic web best practices, and on the ODP movement, actually, that, for example, finds a home in our ontologydesignpatterns.org portal. In slide 15, I refer to what we call pattern-based design or extreme design. And
Eldo, were we on slide 14 now, 15?
15, yes, correct.
Okay, please mention it.
Yeah, I mentioned that sometimes I forget. So the I define pattern-based ontology design as the activity of searching, selecting, composing different patterns and performing testing and integration of pair design sessions. I will mention something and point you to the material if you want to explore more. There is quite a taxonomy of design patterns that emerge for ontologies, including logical, knowledge, aspect, reasoning, architectural. I won't, of course, explore each of them. And this is considered, as I told, the common framework to understand modeling choices of the solution space with reference to task and domain-oriented requirements, which is the problem space. So we are clearly in the good old golden problem-solving framework that we found at least from the work of Simon in the 60s. So you can see some information about this, the catalogs of design patterns that have been collected on ODP portal in the next slides. I won't describe them, also some taxonomy of these types. Then we can go to briefly to slide 19, that shows the continuum that exists between two of the main types of these patterns, i.e. the logical versus knowledge patterns. So here you can see, I won't go into extreme detail here, these are very, very elementary patterns. You can see, so it's the fact that on one hand you can may want to talk about the fact that inflammations can be localized in some body part in the medical field, for example. And by the way, this pattern is on one hand can be generalized as a logical pattern, which is, for example, in OWL, I mean a class which is subclass of restriction. But on the other hand, can be specialized as a more specific knowledge pattern, like colliders, sorry for the example, being localized in a column. Or you can have even data patterns, like having multiple triples that use the is localized in property. Or you can find also linguistic patterns related to that. So here, this slide is mainly to show you that there is some continuum between logical and content aspect. That can be described simply and can be reused efficiently when you have similar problems. So here there is a list of sample knowledge patterns from slide 20 on. They also are called content patterns. So there is some, as in all fields, there is a shifting of terminology. So it's like, I won't present them, of course, but it's like anyway, there is a very general one. So it's a situation pattern. It's very general. It's used to talk about all sorts of relations that are more than binary. So, for example, in languages like description logics, especially OWL, that won't allow for entities, you may use this in order to have a vocabulary to formalize entity relations. And you have a specialization of this, like describing observations in slide 22, or even aquatic resource observation. This is slide 23 is an example of a situation pattern that is materialized for fishery experts. This is something we did with FAO and the NIEN project. And then there are others, okay, time interval of parthood or time index participation. This is another general pattern in slide 26 specializes the situation patterns. And also about crimes in slide 27. In slide 28 and 29, you can see some examples of anti-patterns, so negative examples of practice, of bad practices. And, you know, many of you probably have already encountered them in existing ontologies or when working with the main experts. So confusing, for example, partonomies and subject classifications with subsumption hierarchies, or linguistic disjunction as class disjointness, or slide 29, causality as entailment, or defining multiple domains of ranges of properties as intersections, and so on. In slide 30, I introduce now, I'll tell you briefly something about extreme design method. In slide 31, you can see this it's called the XD iteration. There is a reference also to some course and training for knowing more about this. For example, this iteration is partly supported by the tool that I mentioned before, the XD Extreme Design Tool for the NIEN Toolkit. But essentially, you can see that it's based, it's partly inspired by extreme programming method, but essentially it's based on getting acquainted with the requirements, by collecting stories, then analyzing stories into competency questions. Then, by the way, this work is divided typically in pairs. We have performed experiments. I will talk briefly in a few couple of minutes. And then you can select the knowledge patterns, for example, that are most useful for modeling the competency questions extracted from stories. And then you may compose these patterns, and you can have typically another pair in the design team that makes the integration. And then you can test and fix what has been done. And then you can release module and then integrate. Okay, you can imagine what kind of workflow can be started with. But the basic elements are having this pair design approach, using stories, using competency questions, using heavy testing. In the next, there is also this XT tool that helps in slide 32. There is a reference to it. In slide 33 to 35, there are a bit more detail about the methods, like using unit tests to validate the ontology developed so far in the extreme design workflow. In slide 34, you have, this is related, for example, to extra competency questions. So you want to perform some kinds of reasoning about your domain knowledge, then you may want to perform inferences as a testing. And in slide 35, you can see also is related to stress tests. For example, for a negative example of typical errors that could then stress the ontology in order to check if typical errors are found. This is been partly implemented in the XT tool. Then if we go to slide 37, you can see a screenshot, of the session of the XT tool in the Neon Toolkit, in which you can see the browsing reusable patterns, or seeing annotations, metadata about patterns, and see some automatic warnings that are produced by the tool when analyzing your ontologies against good practices. Okay, this is a very quick environment. In slide 38, I will mention in these three slides some evidence about experiments we did. So the first one was from a paper published at KCAP 2009, that content patterns improve the quality of ontologies. So these experiments we made with master and PhD students, and this quality was measured in terms of covering the task, covering being error-free, and also based on subjective perception, smooth and good design. A further set of experiments were carried out in this slide 39, and the results were published at ECO 2010. Here, extreme design method seems to further improve quality and also improve coverage of the proposed requirements after some refinement. This was made also an experiment with the typical pair design approach. This where we had also this final session with seven PhD design pairs with composed of PhD students. In slide 40, there is also a reference also on evidence that ODP-based ontology learning improves results. In this case, Eva Blomqvist from her lab found out that the ontologies produced or learned automatically by Text2Onto, which is a quite well-known ontology learning tool, then refined by means of the OntoCase tool that uses knowledge patterns. Then she found that ontologies are better in terms of cohesion, consistency, functional quality, etc. So, coming back to our previous slide that I had presented already at the beginning, then you can see again what I presented. So again, I would say the crucial aspects are having tools to select ontologies in an ex post way, having some tools also to measure, evaluate them, and even an ex ante approach by following these extreme design methods, and being able to respond to requirements and to have a quality assurance-like approach to assess your ontologies. And then also being able to imagine, although this has not been performed yet, so tackling the suggestion by John Sowa on measuring the actual enhancements that were, so the successful stories about changing something. This could be ideally done, I think, as far as my knowledge is concerned, is about monitoring the integration, for example, made by coordinators pairs in a extreme design session. Lens slides are about, you know, the reference to training material on the ontology design pattern portal. And you also find some references to what I said and with the bibliographic references at the end. Okay, I thank you very much. I hope not to have taken too much time in order to concentrate also for discussion at the end. Thanks.
Thank you, Aldo. That was an enormous amount of material all at once. we could take a little bit of time for one or two just clarificatory questions.
I have, Amanda, one question. I'm Ravi.
Okay.
Quick question is, how many changes do you find when you go from design to reference or implementation patterns when you get done?
I try to interpret your question, okay? So you mean once a design team has produced an ontology based on this methodology, then what happens when you are going to really implement it in a running system together with other components? Because, of course, ontologies are just one of the components of the system. Is this correct?
Very good, yes.
Oh, okay. Definitely, this is not something we have already experimented with. And I thank you very much for giving us such a suggestion. Also, this is kind of related also to what I was telling about measuring enhancements. So this is something we should take into account in and experimenting with. From my personal experience, but of course this is not objective, this is my impression. Is that the adjustments, is that, you know, you may see these methods if taken, for example, I did an ontology for CNR, for my organization, for managing all the scientific information in CNR, and then we produced also under this ontology linked data and so on. Okay, but the ontology originally was made intellectually totally by a couple of persons many years ago. And it took quite a time to be developed, although based on good practices anyway. But then we tried to redo it with a team of designers with this extreme design. And what they did was made in one afternoon, essentially. This is quite impressive. And, of course, the quality of what they did was not comparable to, you know, 100% of what we did at the time. That I don't remember actually how much time exactly I took, but it was possibly between a couple of weeks and 1 month by a very expert one, I suppose, since I work in this field for 20 years. But okay, by the way, the interesting point was for example, the coverage of the ontology was around 70%. And the quality was quite good. And I don't have the real figures here to give you. So I will try to collect them and send out because this could be quite interesting. So definitely this could be seen as a rapid prototyping, producing an ontology that is relatively robust with respect to what you would like to do for the final. But of course, for even the ideal stuff, of course, you may think that you want some, you know, extreme refinement, not extreme design in that case. So this cannot be excluded. So the role of a very, very, very high expertise cannot be reproduced just by collecting good practices and extreme design. But you can imagine the advantage of being able to do things quite quickly.
Thank you.
Okay. We'd better cut it at that and save additional questions until after the further presentations. Thank you, Aldo. So now on to Jennifer Williams with a more implementation side approach.
So good afternoon, everybody. I am Jennifer Williams, and I work at HiFleet, which is a semantic solutions company based in Baltimore, Maryland. I titled my talk, System Requirements and the Unobtrusive Ontology, to hint at one way that I've seen some success integrating semantics into a large-scale software system. And the motivation for this is that I expect some of you, like me, may have worked on software projects where even the need for ontology is not perhaps universally heartfelt among the development team. It's not always custom made for our ontology development satisfaction. So I wanted to try to describe my experience in using an expressive ontology as part of a large-scale data federation system, but using it unobtrusively, which to me meant making essential contributions to the system, but not burdening the software development staff with what they regard as just ontological issues. So next slide, please. We're on slide 2. I'm giving some context for the talk. When Amanda contacted me about giving a talk, I looked at the title of the track and saw Implementing Ontology Quality Measures in Big Systems Engineering. And I felt some trepidation because I've worked over the past several years on a project implementing ontology in big systems engineering, but I'll be the first to admit that our quality program has been developed by the seat of our pants. And it's at least somewhat effective, but I wouldn't call it a science yet. So I was really interested to participate in this discussion. To the extent we're looking at quality satisfaction as requirement satisfaction, I thought it might be interesting to share my project's approach, which is that the ontology itself does not directly respond to system requirements, at least system requirements as they would be familiar to the customer as they emanate them, or familiar to the systems engineering team as they elaborate them. We use the ontology in our system as a tool to arrive at the fit-for-purpose artifacts that do have to respond to the system requirements. And I'm going to try to give some sense for how we do that. Next slide, please. On slide 3, I'll just refer to the project I've been working on as the knowledge system. It's a system federation effort for a large-scale analytic application. So your typical data federation from existing source systems to allow certain analytic processes to run over all the data and capturing the implicit subject matter knowledge that underpins those data sources and, of course, making it explicit in the model. So that's the goal of the system, is just to power large-scale analytics over a bunch of federated data. And the idea, of course, is that the users will have the best experience understanding and working with the data if it's as semantically unified and organized as possible. So the way the modeling team for this project found we could best help with this was to become involved in all parts of the system that touch the semantics of the data, from data mapping from the sources and ingest, through its manipulation within the analytic engine in the knowledge system, all the way to its display to end users. So it was really a semantic stewardship approach where we kind of held the hand of the data all the way. We had to do this, we had to take part in the system requirements analysis, which I suppose is traditionally a systems engineering role. We had to become part of the team to receive the high-level functional requirements from the customer and elaborate these into requirements for our system components and their capabilities. We found that we had to do this, it was essential, because we had to know what the components, the middleware, the user interface, data ingest, the engine, what they all needed to do so that we knew what support the model needed to provide them specifically. And so how does that happen? How does the model help provide support to the development team? That's covered in the second set of bullets. We found we needed a few components to do that. And the first is what we call the reference ontology. And that's the application-independent, ontologically robust, as much as we can manage, logical model of our subject matter domain. So it's your usual semantic federation central model. And long ago in the past of the project, the modeling team's responsibilities really stopped there. We built the central reference model, and we expected that the system component teams would find the right ways to have their parts of the system conform to those semantics we defined and we gave them. Astonishingly, this didn't work perfectly. And all the reasons for that are probably a different talk and probably all too familiar to those of you who've worked on this sort of system. We found in Able to actually, to make it actually work better, we had to also formalize models about the knowledge system itself. And we call these system interface definitions. We were modeling the interfaces between system components, the areas where you hand off knowledge about the data. So we started just modeling the interfaces between modeling and other teams, our handoff points, the modeling handoff points. But then we found we really ought to branch out to provide semantics preserving component to component interface definitions. Everywhere the data transfers within the system, we have to preserve and steward the semantics. So great. So now we've got our logical reference model. We know what parts of it, what our system interfaces need to do. We found we needed to have a formal or at least semi-formal scoping of the work, and we call that a scenario model. That's how we refer to our model of the scope of the work for a given development cycle. So the customer came to us, gave us a sense for what they were trying to do, and we broke it down to a representation of what's the knowledge needed to power the contemplated analytic capabilities or extensions. This turns out to be, since it's an incremental project, it's a subset of our existing model, plus, of course, a few extensions to accommodate what's new. Whenever new capabilities are being added, that development cycle. So the reference model doesn't grow symmetrically in all areas. We focus on different capability extensions at one time or another, and we have techniques to help manage the modular, chunky development this entails, but that too is another topic. So the result is in the last bullet. The result is that the analytic demands, which are specified in the scenario model and which are semantically controlled by the reference ontology, and which are delineated in their implementation by the interface definitions, each system interface, are used to produce a set of modeling teams produce config files. They're basically a set of configs used directly by the system component teams. And we just refer to this set of artifacts collectively as the implemented model. Next slide, please. So this is a cartoon attempting to depict what I was just clumsily trying to describe. Invisibly up at the top, the customer describes what they want to do. They describe the system capability goals for a given development cycle. And then the modeling team is part of analyzing the intended capabilities and developing the scenario model. So what's going to be involved? The scope of the model that's needed. So say the customer wants to begin to answer questions about disease epidemiology. The scenario model will sketch the needed concepts, the relationships, and the rules having to do with the diseases, their vectors, the modes of transmission, whatever, basically, is needed to answer the analytics that the customer wants to do. And this isn't really where it's formalized. It's just where we scope out the idea that we need some concept, say, of disease vector. Now, the scenario model then scopes the kinds of data and whatever new concepts, relationships, and rules are need to be in the reference ontology. And I'm trying to detect that with the line labeled mappings and extensions between scenario model and reference ontology. On the other hand, between scenario model and interface definitions, the scenario model requirements have been broken down according to what the components or the system functions need to do. So we know what the system components need to hand off at their interfaces. So these are the component requirements. Down at the bottom, the implemented model is finally produced. It's reflecting the demands posed by the scenario model, the semantics defined and constrained by the reference ontology, and knowledge about what the component interfaces each individually need to do contributed by the interface definition. And here's really the take-home message of the whole talk. The implemented model is, as far as the whole rest of the knowledge system development team is concerned, it's all we do. It's the work product of the modeling team. It's a set of what they view as config files, essentially, that have the semantics information needed by each system component, whether it's middleware, whether it's the data mapping guides, whether it's the user interface. And those teams, the development teams, don't care how we arrive at these tools for them. They only care that if they use these semantic config files, nobody yells at them for messing up the semantics of the data. It was we, the modeling team, who found that we needed the help of the formalized reference ontology to maintain semantic consistency, the scoping information of the scenario model, and the implementation information of the interface definitions to be able to produce what the software teams need. And we know that we need new things because for a while we were developing our implementation system, we produced these config files manually. And it took an unbelievable amount of effort, and they always contained errors, large or small. So next slide, please. This is slide 5. How exactly we do this isn't today's topic, but I thought it might be interesting just to get a sense for the ways in which these artifacts are expressed, to get a sense for the information flow through the system. Very briefly, the scenario requirements come in from our customers as English language descriptions, probably pretty familiar to anyone who's received system requirements. The modeling team is part of analyzing them to produce the needed reference ontology extensions. And these are expressed in the reference ontology as ECLIF axioms. And ECLIF is the extended common logic interface format dialect of CLIF, which is used by the high-speed reasoning system. The scenario model is also analyzed to produce the requirements on the software components we've talked about, which are the interface definitions. And we also capture these as more ECLIF axioms. Importantly, I think this is also where we capture any ontologically problematic compromises we have to make in the formal ontological model that we need to do to allow the system to function. Because, you know, as we know, sometimes you have to make compromises to meet deadlines or whatever's going on with your system. Things happen, and you need a place to accommodate wiggle room like that between your formal model and your actual rubber meets the road implemented model. So the ECLIF, the axioms of the reference ontology and of the interface definitions, plus the actual data mapping model, which I haven't shown, are run through the HiFleet XKS reasoning engine to ensure their internal logical consistency and also to some extent the ontological consistency insofar as that's supported. And by means of certain queries we set up on the implementation engine, which is just what we call this loaded reasoning engine. It's got all the implementation data on it. We use these the results of these queries to produce the config files which are particular to the needs of each system component, which we happen to convey to them in XML format only because they like it that way. There's nothing magical about XML format for that. In the lower left-hand box with the red text, are some examples of the kinds of information we provide to the components, and each is tailored to the component. So, for example, all the components typically need to know about the valid classes and valid relations, but actually some components may care about them at different levels of granularity. Some components may only deal with upper-level classes. Some components may deal with every single detailed class, and that's when they've got to be able to also refer to the function hierarchy. User interface display names are a big deal for the user interface team, but really nobody else in the system cares about them. So you can let the UI teams have as many different sets of UI display names or querying shortcuts or graphics that they want to display to their users for as many different sets as they want for their different user bases or user communities. And it doesn't interfere with anybody else. And it's all semantically tied back, of course, to the central semantic, I should have said mechanically tied back by the axioms to the central common semantic. So that's just a brief look at the how and the format. Next slide, please. On slide 6, I just wanted to give a sense for some of the lessons learned that led to us going to this model of trying to provide ontological value to the development teams without providing them with any ontological burdens as they view it. The first one is use the model early for user acceptance. And that's made easier for us because the ontology development tool we use allows us to combine sample data with our interface description information to give users an early kind of rough look at what the finished system will eventually produce so we can emulate the kinds of query responses they're going to get back from the system. And this is so helpful because it allows early identification of errors in their specs, which happens, or our understanding of their specifications. Next is that is modeling team responsibility for data semantics throughout the system. It did not work for the modeling team to not be involved from the very beginning in elaborating customer requirements into the derived requirements for the system. We needed to know what the system needed to do so that we could support the components in doing their jobs with the model. The third point is it did not work for us to throw the model over the wall to our system developers and expect them to be able to just do what they needed to do to maintain the system's essential semantics, but also to know when and how to bend the model to accommodate implementation exigencies. Things happen when you're developing a computer system. So they needed to know where to bend. That really shouldn't be their job. That should be the job of the semantic stewards, which is the modeling team. The fourth point is that we didn't even want to try to give our system component teams the physical models, like laying out their database tables. That's their business. We provide them with what they view as config files that specify what data characteristics they need to maintain and what they need to be able to manipulate and hand off between components. And that is decoupled from the way that they actually implement it. So we do our semantic business, they do their implementation business. And then the last point is that we found that having the interface definitions and the scenario model requirements written down and formalized as much as possible really helped the test team know what each component had to do with the data at each handoff point. And they like having that support to support their testing. And then the last slide, please, slide 7, is the to-be-done, an overview of where we haven't gone yet. So the process is not quite as smooth yet, as I've kind of implied in the overview. There are lots of sticky bits that would like to smooth out yet. Notably, the scenario models could be a lot more formal in their linkage to customer requirements so that it would be easier for us in the end to demonstrate requirement satisfaction. I would like to see a more formal linkage between what the system ends up doing with the data or what is specified in the scenario model and the requirements as they came in from the customer. Another point is that sometimes the ontological compromises I mentioned for system exigencies that we make between the strong reference model and the implemented model are not very well documented. Usually what they are or why we did them, usually because we're rushing. When you're making compromises like that, you're usually under pressure of some sort. The second point is that we still feel like we have gaps in our quality assurance. The centrally generated config files really help assure consistency between how all of the components are handling the data, but they don't assure completeness. So you could have a whole bunch of mappings missing, say, from a data source that you really ought to have in there, and we haven't yet figured out a way to assure completeness of everything we should be doing. So that's kind of our next area that we're tackling. And then lastly, it's probably evident that to be able to involve the modeling team as semantic stewards throughout the whole system, you need the people who understand how your particular system works. What are the constraints? What are the development methodologies chosen by each of the system components to be able to understand how the model can support what the system is trying to do? What artifacts or configs or parameters should be in the model to support the particular needs of the system components? That can be a disjoint skill set from somebody who is strong in formal ontology, for example. But we found that you can have modularity in your team. You can have the modeling team having people who say are strong in formal ontology and other people who are strong in this more systems engineering component satisfaction part of things. We found another mitigator for that last point was that once we provided the software component teams, the middleware guys, say, or the UI guys, with a config file that has helped them remain semantically in sync with the rest of the system, which with much less effort on their part. Then they started coming to the modeling team to suggest more ways that our internal implementation model could be expanded to capture more of the system metadata, more of the stuff that they needed to do. So it has begun to be a little bit of a snowballing effect, which is satisfying. And that's all I have. So thanks for listening.
Thanks very much, Jennifer. That was a very insightful, or I should say, insight generating look from a unusually successful, I would say, implementation process. And also congratulations on being the only one of us who managed to produce a reasonably sized set of slides. we could perhaps take one quick clarificatory question, if somebody has one. More exploratory questions, let's hold, since we are behind. Okay, Todd Schneider, got his hand up. Go ahead, Todd.
Jennifer?
Hi.
Hi. I put two questions on the chat board. You can answer them there. The first had to do with how much impact your modeling work did on the actual design, and then if you could say a bit more about what are in these config files, but you can answer on the chat board if you'd like. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. I'll take a look at that.
Okay. Thanks again, Jennifer, and let's move on ahead to Nicola. Nicola, are you ready? Unmute.
Do you hear me?
Yes, we hear you.
Okay, thanks, Amanda. So I would go again on the issue of ontology design patterns and how the use of ontology design patterns impact on ontology quality. So let's go directly on the first slide, the one with the drawing. This is just a quick recap on what an ontology is. This is taken from the paper with Daniel Overle and Stephen Stab on the ontology handbook. Basically, the very purpose of an ontology is to characterize the conceptualization. So to let people understand the meaning of the terms we use to refer to a certain conceptualization. So the conceptualization is the result of a number of abstractions from our experience, and we come up with a domain of things which are relevant for us and a number of conceptual relations. And when we want to use the language, our own language, to talk about what we have in mind, the problem is that the terms of this language can be ambiguous. So this is the main problem an ontology has to address, the fact that the terms we use are ambiguous. This means you can have multiple interpretations. So this is the gray circle in the figure. These are all the possible interpretations of the language we use. And the problem is to focus on the intended interpretations. A good ontology is an ontology which captures these correct interpretations. And a bad ontology is an ontology which doesn't capture the intended interpretations. I'm very quick here, but this is just to clarify the kind of point of view I have in mind. And for me, evaluating an ontology is, first of all, to evaluate it with respect to how well this ontology clarifies the intended meaning of a vocabulary. And in slide 4, we have a bunch of different situations. depending how the models conveyed by the ontology, that the models constrained, admitted by the ontology axioms, overlap with the actual intended models. In the first case, a good ontology is an ontology which is quite well overlapping the intended models. The point is that it is very rare the case where the ontology models coincide with the intended models, because in practice, and this is the case, the second case, the green ontology, the less good ontology, is an ontology which is a little bit imprecise, because besides, everything it says is correct, but there are certain things which are not clearly specified, so there is a certain possibility of ambiguity. The third case, the blue ontology, the bad one, is an example of over-specification. You are saying too much, and you are excluding, the ontology is over-constrained, so we are excluding certain interpretations. So this is this means that there are two main dimensions according to which we can measure the quality of an ontology. The first one is called correctness, and the second one is called precision. The correctness it concerns to how much the things you say in an ontology are correct. Indeed, the ontology doesn't say anything wrong. And precision is related to how much you actually capture the intended cases. In slide four, I would like to, however, to motivate the need of a third dimension for evaluating an ontology. Besides precision and correctness, there is something else which is needed. And the example I refer in this slide is the following. Suppose you want to build a very little ontology which clarifies the meaning of the own relations in the blocks world. So you want to say, when is the case that the two blocks are on each other? And so you have to explain, what does it mean for a block to be on another block? And you start writing your axioms. So of course, you have to clarify what the domain is, and suppose you only focus on blocks. The only things you talk of are blocks. And you introduce a predicate, a binary predicate, on, and you start thinking about the axioms to put in your ontology, and you realize that on is asymmetric and anti-transitive. Okay, there in the example there is an axiom for anti-transitivity. And the question now you have is the question which occurs often when people do ontologies. Where to stop? These are just two axioms which are intended to describe the meaning of on, and you don't know whether you are happy with them or maybe you should do something else. And in order to check whether this very tiny ontology consisting of just two axioms is good, you have to check, you might just check the models, but the models, it happens that indeed all the models of these ontologies, this is a tiny ontology, are indeed the right one. The problem is that still there is something you cannot do with this ontology, namely explaining the difference between the three examples shown in the at the bottom to the right. Okay, so in particular, you cannot tell with this ontology, you cannot tell why when there are two blocks are just one above the other one with a gap in between, why this is not a case of on, and why when there are two blocks just in touch on a corner, why this is not a case of on. In other words, in order to evaluate the quality of an ontology, the first conceptual tool you have is to come up with examples and counterexamples. An ontology is good if the ontology can actually discriminate good examples from counterexamples. In this case, this is not possible. And let's go to the next slide, slide number 6, to understand why it is not possible. The reason is that in the previous case, we only focused on a domain of discourse which only involved blocks. Our ontology, the tiny ontology we developed, only talks about blocks. This ontology is not able to talk about, for instance, regions of space. That's why we have no way to account for the fact that there is an empty region between the two blocks, C and A, in the previous example. So the first reason why this tiny ontology is not good enough is because the choice of the domain of discourse is too simple. We have to introduce something else. In order to talk, to understand what does it mean to be on something else, besides talking of blocks, we also have to talk about regions of space. This is the first region. So the domain is needs to be expanded. The second region, the primitives we use are not enough because we only have one primitive, on, and maybe we need another primitive, say, contact or something like that in order for distinguishing the various cases. Maybe we need a primitive to account whether or not a block occupies a certain region of space. So this example shows that precision and correctness are not enough for measuring the quality of an ontology. We need to introduce another dimension, which is accuracy. So precision is related to how much non-intended models are excluded. Accuracy is related to how much negative examples are excluded. And the key difference here is the difference between the logical notion of model and the ontological notion of example. Examples are in the reality. Models are just, technical things. So let's move to slide 7. So this is just a recap of the three dimensions for judging the quality of an ontology, which I would like to point out. Correctness is where no ontology constraint is wrong. Precision is when the ontology actually can discriminate between wrong and correct statements. And accuracy is when the ontology can actually discriminate between wrong and correct examples. Let's move to now to slide number 8. There is a misprint in the slides. Just to introduce a few comments concerning ontology design patterns. Let's go to slide 9 now. What is the main problem, in my opinion, for ontology design patterns? It is there is a crucial trade-off between reusability and interoperability. In software design, for instance, design patterns have been introduced mainly in order to facilitate reusability. Interoperability was not the reason why design patterns have been introduced in software engineering. The problem is that in our case, if we want to borrow this idea of design patterns from the software engineering community, we have to take into account that ontologies are a very special kind of piece of software, and their first reason there is reusability. And there is this problem since the more an ontology pattern is reused, reusable, this means it has to be very underspecified. But the more underspecified the ontology pattern is, the less interoperable the resulting ontology is, just because the people may specialize these design patterns in the way they like, with no constraints, no guarantee of interoperability. Let me make a couple of examples, which are taken from the ontologydesignpatterns.org portal, which Aldo mentioned. For instance, suppose I want to use this design pattern of part of, okay? So the idea is to do things very, 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 very simple, okay? So in a sense, although these patterns are taken from foundational ontology, they are actually extrapolated, and the idea is to use them in isolation. So this means that people may misunderstood what part is. And for instance, if we only say that part is transitive, there are tons of relations which are transitive, and this is not enough to really make sure, for instance, not to confuse part of with ancestor of or any other transitive relation. So nobody guarantees that people really share this, which the different people which use the same pattern really share the same understanding of what part of is. If you, a similar example is for a member collection, for components and so on. For instance, slide number 13 shows a possible misinterpretation of the notion of part. This is taken from an actual paper. And basically, in this the picture which we see there, basically this this large arrow between ABS and car is intended to convey the fact that car has only one part, which is ABS. Now, we know from formal ontology, from mereology, that it is impossible for something to only have only one single proper part. This is a violation of the mereology axioms. But if we only say that part of is transitive, this constraint is ignored. Anyway, there are other examples which are shown in the pictures, which I'm going to skip. The final comment I want to make concerns the use of competency questions for developing ontologies, and in particular for developing design patterns. Competency questions have been extremely successful as a methodology for designing ontologies, and are indeed used in many cases. For instance, all these patterns are supposed to answer to a certain set of competency questions. Also in slide 16, you see also other examples of competency questions which are taken from the Good Relations ontology, which is a very popular ontology for e-commerce. So these competency questions are pretty much popular. However, look at the surface of these competency questions. They are, most of all of them are what or which questions. Okay? In a sense, they are lookup questions. Okay? You have a concept or something, and you have to the question concerns how to access to some particular attribute or property or other concept which is related to the focused one. So, indeed, if we, this form for competency questions is very different from the original idea of competency questions from their inventors. In slide 17, you see a quotation from one of the original papers by Mike Oshald and Mike Groninger. Unfortunately, none of them is there today. And they say, it is not a well-designed ontology if all competence equations have the form of simple lookup queries. This is their quotation. And in slide 18, which is taken from another paper involving Mike Groninger, maybe the idea of competence equations is even clearer. Basically, the competence equations are there in order to come up with the right axioms which define and constrain the data model. So the competence equations should, first of all, elicit constraints concerning the meaning of things. So let me skip slide number 19 and let me give my own, understanding of this situation. I believe we should distinguish between epistemological and ontological competence equations. Epistemological competence equations are just simple lookup questions. Okay, so what are the parts of this entity? This is simple. Okay, this answering this question it's very simple because you can just put a simple relation in your model and you are done. Okay. On the other hand, if you think of those questions which help to understand the meaning of the things you are modeling. Then, if you properly divide these questions, you can actually learn how the kind of constraints you have to express. And well, I'm not going through all these examples now. Let me just go to slide 21 to convey the kind of methodology I have in mind in order to, to come up with a decent quality ontology. Well, first of all, we discussed whether we have to focus the particular applications or not. I prefer, because of this main interoperability issue, we shouldn't focus on a particular application, but we can focus on a target community to make sure what are the people who are going to use a certain ontology. For instance, the various people working at different departments in a large system, in a large organization. Okay? Isolate the community and then start looking at the terminology you want to put in the ontology and see whether there are some terms which are ambiguous. Maybe the term part is understood in different ways, maybe the term service is understood in different ways, and so on. For each of these terms, which is ambiguous for that community, collect examples and counterexamples, like for the case of being one block on the other one, and make sure that the ontology is able to avoid misunderstanding concerning the meaning of terms for that particular target community. And you stop when the term, let's say person, for instance, say maybe you don't need a sophisticated ontology of persons as long as the people you are talking of know very well what a person is. So, the final slide, my conclusions, concern the two main risks of ontology design patterns. At least, not necessarily, the very idea of ontology design patterns is nice, but the problem is to make sure, if we really want to use these ontology design patterns, to make sure they are not underspecified. Underspecification for ontology design pattern encourages irreducibility, but decreases interoperability, and therefore produces bad ontologies. The other risk with ontology design patterns concerns the modularity. Of course, modularity is a very nice thing, but if we really strip out small modules from the context, we may risk to miss structural connections. For instance, in the ontology design patterns.org, componenthood and parthood are listed as separate design patterns, but they are very much related one each other. So focusing on isolated patterns risks to overlook important structural connections. And that's it for today. Hello?
Amanda or Mike? You're both muted. Hang on.
Sorry about that. I was talking but muted.
Nicola, thank you very much for that. Again, you could possibly do one.
You're very muffled, Amanda.
Okay. We could possibly have time for one very brief clarificatory question, and otherwise we'll hold the substantive discussion a bit longer. Is there anything anybody wants to ask quickly that's a clarification? I think that
there's
plenty of... Sorry, who was that?
No, it's Mike. I was just saying, excellent. In that case, over to Amanda to present her much-anticipated slides. So... I think you should be up on the, are your slides up on the thing? Just a minute or so while Peter gets those up. I think there's some interesting issues coming through on the chat, some of which go a lot deeper, which we can come on to in the general discussion, and hopefully we'll also get time for the questionnaire session that was mentioned earlier. So, over to you, Amanda.
Okay, thank you, and Mike, I'll be relying on you to... share and to keep me in line if I start going off somewhere.
Yeah, I will have to mute Mike in the interim because your line is introducing a lot of hum.
Oh, is it? I'm sorry.
It
I didn't realize.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so I want to talk a bit about really zooming in on the requirements issue, requirements specification issue, and how practically systems engineers and others can approach ontology quality assurance with a fit for purpose perspective. I have far too much content on these slides. I won't read through all of it, but we'll use it to, I think, to highlight a few points. Go to slide two. The first notion, this is something we've talked about, it's been talked about in various ways. I am introducing a term here so that it's easy to talk about it. Refer to it as we go on, and that is ontology quality factors. And what I mean by this is specifically the features that any given ontology can have or not have that tend to be factors in fitness for purpose. That is, they tend to matter in an ontology's ability to meet the requirements of a particular usage. There's a lot of variation across these quality factors in that some of them are more universally relevant than others, and how they vary with usage is also itself largely variable. Some of these quality factors are all or nothing, that is, an ontology is maybe either decidable or not. Can't be sort of, right? Or they can be, or the factor may be something that can an ontology can possess in degrees, like coverage and linguistic support and so forth. Some of these are easily understood in a quantitative way. Some of them are qualitative. Some of them are accompanied by well-understood metrics, and others are not. Some are easy to measure. Some are not. Some have evaluation techniques that are almost strictly manual. Some are very easy to check in an automated way, and some require a mixed technique, taking a little of each to the other. And they vary a lot in how costly they are to measure or satisfy. Now, just without even having looked at what some of them are, just looking at that list, you can see that if what I've just said is true about ontology quality factors, then there's a lot of payoff to figuring out for your particular usage which ontology quality factors are significant. That is, what do you need to look for in an ontology to use for your purpose? And your answer to that, right, is going to have an enormous effect on how easy, difficult, costly, less costly, time-consuming or not, that your assessment and quality assurance are. Slide 3, please. Now, the next two slides are titled A Partial Inventory of Ontology Quality Factors. This is not complete by any means. It is, there is no complete list that I know of, but there are a number of attempts to generate them. These are these two pages cover ontology quality factors I see coming up the most. In this page, you see the most frequently relevant. Well, the first one, the formal soundness, that is a logical consistency and so forth. I have put under that this is absolutely necessary and almost never sufficient. This is very important. Even if an ontology is not going to be used for any reasoning, it's not going to be machine processed, say, or if it's really the process, the analysis process that's providing the value, or it's really being used as a sort of more structured glossary, even in those cases, it's absolutely necessary that the formal soundness be there. Here's what I mean by that. We've all seen increasingly many things put into OWL and called an ontology. Sometimes the complaint about this is that they just simply don't use most of the logical features. That's not what I'm talking about. Fine. Don't use them. There may be cases where that's good. But if you use an OWL construct, something a term that's predefined, such as subclass of, you don't get to choose what it means. It means what the formal semantics of OWL says subclass of means. In an amazing number of cases, people will produce and attempt to deploy ontologies that fail that test, often because they don't understand the formal semantics. An ontology that fails that test not only fails to be machine readable and usable, it fails to be humanly interoperable because you've taken away the one biggest gain that the ontologies over free text gives you, which is that some portions of this are constrained by the principles of logic and set theory and these predefined elements. So the meaning of them is not subjective or flexible across users. It's pinned down. So the definitions using those things mean the same thing regardless of reader. I say almost never sufficient. In a couple minutes, I'll say something about how these things are evaluated and it'll, I think, become more clear then why I why this is an important thing to point out. Okay. The other two ontology quality factors I have on this page, accuracy or verisimilitude and coverage, these are related closely to the sorts of things that Nicola was just talking about. I want to say one particular thing about accuracy. There are two popular and wrong, remember now I have my presenter, not my chair, my champion hat on now, so I'm opining freely. There are two popular and wrong views of what accuracy of an ontology means. And they are either that it's completely relative, right? You know, a model is just whatever, and, you know, you've captured what somebody thinks of some particular domain, and it doesn't really matter how it corresponds to things. The other popular and wrong view is that there's one way to model any slice of reality, and that it's independent of conceptualization. This is nonsense. I say this because ontological models are not distinct in nature from scientific models. They are partial, and they are they use the granularity and the way of grouping and relating objects in a domain that is relevant to the practices for which this model is going to be put. So, just like we don't require chemists to use the models from physics, even though physics underlies chemistry, so in theory they could, we don't require that because it's not useful. It's the wrong granularity. It doesn't capture the experience and practice-based and critical distinctions and ways of perceiving things that chemists have developed. Similarly, that's the case here. The other point I want to make about accuracy is that people often fail to pay attention or to ask the question, what exactly am I modeling? Not just my domain, what am I modeling? Because sometimes people will argue, is it a model of a conceptualization? Is it a model of the external reality, independent of conceptual? It depends. What's your task? Right? In some cases, you're trying to model a physical process like the Krebs cycle in biology. Okay. In some cases, you're actually trying to model information. And this is increasingly true, especially in federated systems, that you're actually trying to create a model that is sufficient to express any assertion, relationship, information contained in some data. That's how you're providing interoperability. So in most cases, generally, you're trying to model the domain as it is perceived or as distinctions are made in the original information source by people engaged in a particular business process and so forth. So accuracy is not usage independent, right? It depends upon, it's always important, but what it is depends on what the reality is that you're trying to model. Coverage, as with accuracy, it's almost always important. It's only a usable requirement when you add information about what the coverage is that's needed for a particular usage. Okay, so too many times especially in large enterprise applications, you know, modelers or experts will be sort of told to go model a particular domain. And there's no more information than that. There's no granularity to it. Well, that's not useful, right? There's no bottom to it, right? The further, the closer you look, the more distinctions you can make, et cetera. the useful requirement of coverage comes with some specification of what the coverage should be sufficient for. That could be in the form of competency questions. It can be in the form of data streams that need to be translatable in or representable in this ontology and so forth. Okay, slide four. I won't go through every single one of these. This is part two of the partial inventory of ontology quality factors. These are factors that are variably important. The logical characteristics of an ontology may not be that important if you're not doing any particular reasoning with it. You may not care if you have description logic based or first order logic. You may not care if you can represent uncertainty about the efficiency of various kinds of reasoning. Right? In other applications, it's absolutely critical because either complex reasoning is necessary or specific types of reasoning are essential. Similarly, linguistic characteristics. How is this going to be used? Is it going to be used to parse natural language content, index natural language content, generate natural language content, multilingual, not multilingual, etc. Reusability, I'm going to stop on because this came up in the chat earlier. Reusability is itself a ontology quality factor that has varying importance in different usages. In some ontology projects, the requirements just won't include reusability. They'll be perfectly fine with it being a one-off, right, that can't be extended. That's increasingly rare. More often, reusability is not only very important, but reusability by unknown, unpredicted future users from unknown, unpredicted contexts is even important. Extensibility in the same way. Okay, I'm gonna not go through that any further. Slide five. Sample ontology quality assurance measures. I mentioned earlier that that it's important to note that logical validation is not sufficient. One of the reasons that I point that out is that the logical validation, that's under the lamppost, right? That's the easiest thing because the principles that underlie ontologies and the formal semantics, the maturity of inference techniques and so forth, make this the easiest thing to implement if you understand those formal semantics. The tools are there and so forth. You can do this very automatically. And that's important to do. It's a great check and gets you a lot of quality minimum cutoff and so forth. And it's necessary in many ways. And so that's all wonderful. The bad news is that will weed out some really bad ontologies and leave you a whole lot of mixed relevance, mixed usability ones. Next slide, slide six. For accuracy versus similitude, measures are much less well-developed. They're better developed than in some areas. It's more that there's a variety of approaches that can be taken. And this is an area in which more maturity is needed and more guidance is needed. There are many techniques involving domain or subject matter expert validation. unfortunately, in my experience and in my reading, most of these are applied ineffectively. And here I would point, I didn't give a link, but I'll add one in the chat later, to Paul Cohen's work on empirical methods for artificial intelligence. This general experimentation stuff, but he makes a great point about AI work that applies equally well to ontology evaluation and validation generally, which is that researchers and developers are rarely trained in good experimentation, and it shows. Many times the tests that are done to validate particularly the accuracy of ontologies are designed in such a way that they can't answer the question that needs answering. Some of the things that are left out in particular have to do with the human and cognitive factors that influence the SME validation and the ability of the SMEs to simultaneously understand what they're being asked to review and also keep their expert thinking online. Slide 7. I am not going to read through this. I'll emphasize that much of what Jennifer talked about in terms of the importance of having the modelers involved in the requirements generation and understanding from that level, that's very important. I can cite many, many examples besides what her experience that indicate what failure can result when that's not done or when the throw-over-the-wall approach is used, or even worse, when ontology requirements are simply never specified. And I cannot tell you how often I have seen that happen. So I put on at the end of this slide, I said, you know, don't skip this. And insert your favorite horror stories here, and that's a cue to me to not insert them because that would take another hour of anecdotes. Slide 8, this is the last slide, just a few things, general observations. To date, ontology quality factors have not been looked at enough beyond formal validation. There hasn't been enough interplay between the implementation community and the researchers to really drive this. But this is changing. And in the last 5 to maybe 7 years, you see this gradually swinging around, and quite a lot of work is beginning to get generated. If you want to sort of see a small sampling of some of the work that's being done, those of you who've been in the summit discussion mailing list know that we have a recommended readings group library started on Zotero. The link in here points to the sub-collection in there specifically for this cross-track. There's some there's a sampling of items in there that might be of interest. You can also these days check the program of any of the major conferences, take ISWIC, ECOWAS, whatever, and you will almost always find at least one workshop or track or session that's addressing some of these in-practice thorny issues. And finally, something I learned when I attended ISWIC while I was still back at the Air Force project with my solution finding hat on, looking for things that we could bring in to using that project, and talked with some of the researchers, I often found that the research was not adequate and that the researchers weren't delimiting the bounds of their applicability partly because they didn't know that they were significant, and that my the responses I got to questions about applicability across those were actually very enthusiastic requests for use cases. So many researchers don't want to be working on less important things. They just don't know what the important things are. So my recommendation is, if you need some help in your methodology for ontology quality assurance in implementation context, publicize your use case. Present it somewhere. You may find that somebody solves it for you. And that is the end of my talk. It has gone on too long. I'll hand back to Mike.
Right. Mike.
And you have muted him, Peter, so.
Yes, but he can unmute himself. Now he's unmuted. Mike?
So I can.
Yeah.
Thanks, Amanda. That was great. And I think there was a lot of stuff that was worth dwelling on. So I know that we're shorter on time than we'd hoped. But I think you brought out some very important points there. And just a general thought, I know that we all have our own strong ideas about how an ontology should be. And I think a lot of the focus we're getting from this QA cross-track is that what matters is not how you or I or somebody thinks an ontology should be, but how somebody has specified it and how you're actually, you know, how you answer those particular questions for that particular project, I think. I don't know if that helps. Now, we've got 10 minutes. So, Amanda, do you think, should we just go to QA and open discussion and leave those questions, or should we try and, we can perhaps take those questions asynchronously or something later or something like that? What do you think?
Let's see. Let's go to open discussion and see
yep.
how much of a problem is. Just to make clear to everyone the choice we're facing, the ideal plan was, again, to have some Q&A for the panel, open discussion, and then to spend our last, 10, 15 minutes with some pre-written questions and get community response to those. Now, we have the option. We could do that over the email if there's enough general Q&A to take up the time we have left. That's probably more important. So, questions?
Yes. So, people would like to raise their hands if they have a question, and then we'll get to them on that.
Or perhaps everybody's written them out in chat already. Ah, there we go.
There were a lot of questions in the chat, but Peter has his hand up. So, Peter.
A short one for Amanda. Maybe before that, all the presentations today are great, and thank you for putting together this great panel and all the content. That is just amazing. Quick one. I mean, on your slide number 4, I noticed that you sort of put provenance and traceability on different bullets. Was that just a typo? By the other?
Yes. Provenance bookkeeping and reading should be under traceability and trust. That's right.
All right. So maybe you can send me an update and we can
connect
the archive.
Okay.
Simon, you have a question.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, good. The question I had is for the panel, and I think Jennifer raised it implicitly. The question is, when you're iterating and checking with the stakeholders, customers, SMEs, or whichever groups actually can tell whether you've got it right enough, how often or how short a pod, a proof of development cycle or like sprints, depending on which terminologies you're using. How short a cycle do you think is necessary in order to get things not too far off track? And if you have time, or if the other panelists have time, does that, if you have two shorts, does that reduce generality? End of question.
Yes, I would like to. I can tell you what our system does. We have, for the whole system, a delivery or development cycle of 3 months, which seems to be a nice balance that makes the users feel that it's too short and it makes the developers, the users feel like it's too slow, too long, and the developers feel like it's too short. But it is barely long enough for the modeling team to have about a month to go back and forth with users about what the requirements are, and try to get clarification and to show them our roughed out models, and then go to the stage of running through sample data and to show them what kinds of answers they're going to get. And then to flip it over to the development team for their roughly 1 month cycle, and then the test team for their roughly 1 month cycle. So it can seem really very long for our users, but I definitely agree with you with what I think you were saying, that if the development cycle is too short and the modeling has to be flipped around in, you know, a day or a week, then you really end up just meeting the requirements of the data you have in front of you. And it takes me longer than that to develop any substantial chunk of a realist ontology.
Thank you. Any other questions? I don't see any hands up. I know there are a lot of interesting conversations on the chat, so I'm sure we've got time to unpack one or two of those.
I have a general comment.
Yeah.
Ravi, when you talk of measuring quality among, say, quality comparison among different ontologies, one of the factors that has been woven into today's talks is the semantic congruency or synchronization of semantic understanding among these ontologies to be able to compare different ontologies. So what would be a measure of that? Would it be in terms of only vocabularies or terms or dictionaries or namespace congruence? What would come to your mind before you compare, let's say, at least domain similar ontologies for quality?
Would one of the panel like to address that?
I'm not sure I fully understood. Are you talking about the
I have two ontologies, and I want to understand relative to each other what's the quality factors, what are the factors of quality, as in your talk. I can one of the things I would have to ensure is that they are very close to, if not in the same kind of domain, and that they are semantically similar in their operational space, so that we don't compare the quality of apples and oranges.
If what you mean is a coverage question primarily,
domain coverage.
Domain
overlap is one factor, but also deeper would be, let's say, two bioontologies, both dealing with biosystem, both dealing with genes, but how well do we need to understand these semantic parameters, like meaning of words, natural language factors.
Right. Well, in fact, most of some of the more developed coverage comparisons are natural language based and are in bioontology, where this is done quite a lot. Actually, Kevin Cohen, for example, there's at least one paper of his in the group library using statistical natural language comparison to corpus documents in the domain and comparing them to particular ontologies. Now, the limitation there is that that particular approach works differently depending on whether you've got an ontology that mixes or clearly separates the lexical and conceptual levels. It's fairly well developed for small, just hundreds of concepts, ontologies in the same or very close domains. It's not very well developed for the larger scale, although I think that some of the same for well lexically supplemented ontologies, some of the semantic indexing and retrieval techniques can also work. But that's I'm assuming that implemented in a proprietary manner. I've not seen it generally done.
And Nicola's hands up. Are you addressing that same question as well? I know we've just got time.
Yes. Let me try to answer to give my answer to Ravi. So first of all, you have to fix what is the community which is going to evaluate these ontologies. Could be maybe a single community who's using the two ontologies, or maybe you just join the two communities. Anyway, you need to have a set of people, and then you start with the list of terms which are occurring in this the natural language terms occurring in these ontologies, and for each of these terms you ask to the people whether this term is obvious to them or if they require. If the, understanding the term and talking about the term requires some clarification. And if the term is ambiguous, you check whether the ontology helps disambiguating the term. It might be the case that in one case, for one ontology, the constraints are not enough, or maybe there are some misinterpretations or whatever. So basically, this means my strategy, which is a long one, not an easy thing to do, is just to consider these three dimensions, correctness, accuracy, and precision, especially precision. The most relevant one is, in many cases, precision. For each of these dimensions, check whether people are happy while using the ontology for understanding these terms or not. If the ontology leaves things still unclear and still opens misunderstandings for these terms, this means that the ontology is not good.
Not enough good for machine.
Sorry.
Not enough good for machine interpretation or for human understanding or both.
Mainly human understanding. This is the ultimate evaluation criteria to me. Because there are machines in the loop, of course, but ultimately ontologies are there to help people understand each other.
Thank you, sir. That was very good. Very good. But the natural language expertise for even a community as diverse as ours, as ontologists, is very rare. It's exception rather than rule.
Yeah, that's why, indeed, where if there are problems in language, for instance, in some technical terms require clarification, okay, because they have a very specific meaning. And, of course, this is a reason for having good ontologies, or at least good dictionaries, in order to make sure these technical terms do have a unique meaning. Anyway, the discussion will be
longer. Very good. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you very much, Nicola. Thanks, Ravi, for your question.
Thank you, Amanda.
Jennifer, you typed your response into the chat. I don't know if you want to quickly elaborate on it before we wrap up, or have you said it?
Nope. That's it. That's fine. It's all been said.
Fantastic. Well, thanks, everybody, and thanks for your patience. I think we had some very interesting points.
Eldo's hand is up.
Oh, sorry, I didn't notice. Sorry, yes, Aldo, please go ahead. Thanks. Thanks, Peter.
No, I don't want to take much time because we are already late. I just wanted to mention that a lot of things happened in the chat concerning discussions about the different talks. So for those that are not in the chat but only in the call, maybe it could be interesting to check it out. Just that.
Thanks, Aldo. It's a very good point. There's some very interesting points about agile methodologies and things like that, which are well worth looking at. So do please look at the chat once it's online. Right. So, Amanda, do I hand it back to you to wrap up? Or?
I guess I just want to thank everyone who contributed an enormous amount of really useful material, and obviously we could have gone on a deep dive in many different directions from there. Hopefully we'll continue some of this discussion on the email discussion list and or the wiki, and we'll send out the questions for the community that way.
Yes,
well.
Keep your eyes out for the questionnaire, and do please have a go at answering that. That would be very useful. Great. So thank you, everybody. Thanks for some great inputs, and I guess that's it. Peter?
Yeah. So come again. Next Thursday, same time, we'll have the session for Crosstrack A2, where we're going to make an attempt to deal with federation and integration. Till then, bye, everyone.
Hi, everybody.
Great session. Thank you. Bye-bye.